You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra Siam Nisiam Nisiaya, and the Skakulia to lead in Homasqueam Mustail. Hello, listeners, and welcome to Dog Ear Radio Book Club. I'm your host, Randy. Dog Ear Radio Book Club is a bi-weekly book club that airs on CITR 101.9 FM. Every 2 weeks, I invite a guest on to talk about a book that they choose, and we have a lot of fun. You can always reach me at email at dogearedbookclubradio@gmail.com, and you can also follow me on Instagram, which I highly encourage, to get more updates about the show at Dog-Eared Radio Book Club. Today's episode, we are talking about The Jade Temptress by Jeannie Lin, and I am joined today by I'm very excited to have this guest, and I hope that she's also very excited to be here. Welcome to the show, Sanjana. How are you?
I am so good. I am very excited to be here. I'm very excited to talk about this book. I think it's going to be good.
Yeah, I think it will be too. I came across you first on Book Talk, like I do most of my guests. It's either Bookstagram or Book Talk. And yeah, I was really drawn. I think the first content I actually found was about Bridgerton, which is funny because, you know, not super book related. I mean, obviously there is a series Bridgerton. But yeah, I really was drawn to your very nuance is so cliche, but I think in this term it like really fits, but just like very like well thought out. And you brought in this like very good intersectional perspective and lens when you talked about books. So because of that, I'm really interested to hear about your journey of reading. Like, how did you get to this space right now?
Yeah. I mean, I think in some ways it's like a really familiar story where like I grew up being like an incredibly voracious reader up until probably late middle school, where like genuinely I was putting away I had to start lying in my monthly reading reports at school because I didn't think people would believe me in elementary school. Like I was reading I was really obsessed with like the Boxcar Children series. I don't know if you'd ever read that, but it's like a mystery series of these four kids. I was reading like book after book after book. I was reading like several books a night sometimes as a kid, and I wasn't a good sleeper really ever, and I think that partially contributed to it. And then I hit high school and I just like lost interest. I lost time. Reading became an obligation. And I mean, I still really enjoyed the reading I was assigned for school, but like I really had to be on a deadline to get something done. And that was kind of similarly the case in college, where a lot of my reading became academic. And I also didn't really enjoy my undergraduate major in retrospect, so I wasn't even doing much of that reading. And then my senior year of college, it somehow worked out to where I had literally two required classes to take in spring of my senior year. I had a job lined up for the fall. I was sort of set. I had a period of like nearly at that point, like 6 or 7 months where like very little was expected of me. All of my sort of campus student obligations were way reduced. It was just a really weird, opportune moment. And my goal for that year, this was 2019. Yeah, 2019. My goal was to read 52 books in 52 weeks. And I did. I read 52 books. I read more than 52 books. I reported on 52 books, but I read way more than that. Because in summer of that year, I like discovered for myself romance. And that feels weird to say, because actually as a middle schooler and in elementary school, I remember reading books that had like conceptual overlap with romance. But specifically, I came to it because I started a Book of the Month subscription and I picked up Well Met by Jen DeLuca, which was her debut. And I really enjoyed that. And then I sort of accidentally stumbled onto The Madness of Lord Ian McKenzie by Jennifer Ashley. And like that sent me, I was like, historical romance is real. This thing that somehow I have like yearned for my whole life and didn't know about like exists. And like it kind of threw me back to some of the books that I was like pulling out in middle school. I read a series by Y.S. Lee, I think, called The Agency, the YA series about a Chinese and British girl named Mary, who sort of was a private investigator, where she like could pass for white in Victorian era England, and but also was able to sort of assimilate with like dock workers and laborers because she was also a woman of color. And she like was going around solving mysteries in Victorian era London. And I'd also read A Great and Terrible Beauty by Libba Bray. This is such a long answer. This is so much longer than you wanted, I'm sure. But like,
no, I love it. Keep going.
But I read A Great and Terrible Beauty by Libba Bray, which is also a sort of like Victorian colonial period English novel about like a young woman who starts to like dream of this man. Basically, like I had romance reading roots in middle school, but mm-hmm. because that sort of like fun and joyful relationship with reading just wasn't really cultivated beyond that point, it felt like something had like unlocked in me that summer. I went from Jennifer Ashley into starting to read Lisa Kleypas, who of course was like profoundly formative for me as a historical romance reader. Unfortunately, I just like can't let that woman go. Like I will just continue to read everything she's ever written. sometimes in spite of my better judgment, but also because I think like she's incredibly good at what she does. Mm-hmm. And she sort of became like the foundation for my historical romance reading. And I think I'd always sort of had an interest in specifically like Victorian era. I mean, Regency too. Regency is a lot of historical romance, but like I was really interested in the Victorian era because it's like the most recent not in living memory part of human history for like the West.
Right.
We're on the precipice of these huge, huge power structure changes where like imperialism and colonialism are like at the height of their power, but also on the like precipice of collapse. And like industrialization is happening and globalization is happening. And like, we're about to like hit this period of like technological innovation that like rapidly restructures society. But also like the Victorian era is when I sort of realized this a little bit later. I'm talking about this as if this is like the strategy I had all along, but it wasn't like, but the Victorian era is also when we start to like actually develop definitions of what sex constitutes and what marriage mm-hmm. constitutes and like what intimate relationships between men and women are supposed to be. And like somehow those things became codified as like essential qualities of existence, as opposed to like constructed ideals that like developed and were formed by thinkers in the Victorian period. I don't know. I just think that period of history is really fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I like kind of came to explore some of those interests through Kleypas and other historical romance right around then. And then it was like, there was like no solving. There was no saving me after that. After that, I was reading like hundreds of books, genuinely like went down the rabbit hole, like funhouse mirrors everywhere. I was just reading an obscene amount, and now I'm here.
Amazing. Yeah, that's so funny how closely that is to my story. Except for I didn't, I was a huge avid reader in middle school, even into junior high, which I don't, maybe you consider that middle school. But, and then definitely like high school. I remember I had to read The Road by Cormac McCarthy. I hate that book so much. And like, this is not me dissing Cormac McCarthy. I literally know nothing about him. But that book and that, we had to watch a movie too. I wasn't having any of it. And I think then I still kind of read like every once in a while. But I got to the point where I was just buying more books than I was ever reading, and I just couldn't keep interest. And then similar to like you in my, I think it was my second to last year in university though. And it kind of aligned with the pandemic too, where I was just like, I'm going to get a Kobo Plus subscription. And then I just like was like, oh my gosh, I can read all these books for $10 a month. And then that very quickly bled into Kindle Unlimited. And I became insatiable. I was just like, I'm going to read everything. I'm going to read things I've never read before. I'm going to read things that I'm never going to talk about. And yeah, it just like really opened this like whole world. And then I started this show, because I was reading so many books and I was like, I need to talk about some of these books at least. And yeah, it became a great way. So I'm assuming that's somewhere similar to like your story of how you started your TikTok and like got into specifically like the book talk space.
Yeah, that was a little bit more of an accident. Like it really was an accident. I don't think I ever had aspirations towards like being seen by lots and lots of people on the internet. That I still find that kind of an uncanny, funky reality. Not that like I have a like massive audience or anything, but genuinely, truly, it was just one day I posted a stitch to, that was also the first day I created a TikTok account. I didn't even have an account up until I was like, oh, I really like this thing that someone said. Why don't I stitch it and offer my own exploration of it? And then it got like 100,000 views and people wanted me to talk about other things related to what I'd said and elaborate on a point and blah, blah, blah. And then 2.5 years passed and I just kept doing it. It was genuinely like, oh, cool. People are really nice to me and they seem to like care what I have to say. But also truthfully, like so much of my reading and my romance reading had been done in solitary. None of my friends were reading as much as I was. They weren't reading what I was reading. Like a lot of my friends were still reading a lot of, you know, like self-help if they were reading at all. I do think that like for a lot of us, the early isolation of pandemic was a prime opportunity to like really start exploring bookish community, because the internet was really the only way to explore being in community with people. I didn't really have the opportunity to obviously like join a book club in person, and you know, so it was really lucky because it finally put me in touch with this broader world of romance readers. I just like loved being able to talk to and with other people whose perspective I really enjoyed. And I feel like TikTok was the medium for that, even though I don't think of it as a particularly conversational platform. Like you can do stitches, you can do duets. That's some means of interaction, but it really was more useful in terms of putting me in touch with other ways of actually speaking more directly with other romance readers and meeting romance readers in my real life. Once it was safer to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. I just use this show as an excuse now to talk to people that should. I think are cool from the internet. I'm like, please come on my show so I can talk about you. So speaking of romance books, let's dive into the chosen book for this episode, The Jade Temptress by Jeannie Lin. So I don't believe either you or I have read a Jeannie Lin book. Am I correct in that?
Yes.
Amazing.
The prequel to this book.
Yes. I have not either, and it took me a while to realize that there was one, which is just saying more about me than the book. So to kick it off, I'm gonna do the segment that I always do on my show where I read the description of the book and then we'll chat about how accurate it is, and that will lead into our broader conversation. So please forgive me from the get-go for mispronouncing these names. I know I will be. Listeners, I unfortunately did not have time to check the pronunciation of anything. So without further ado, here we go. As the most requested hostess at the Lotus Powell, Ming Yu can charm any man who seeks her company, except Wu Kefeng. Wu is a no-nonsense constable who maintains his level head even in the most desperate situations. Having crossed paths with each other in the past, the two have a strained history. But that doesn't stop Ming Yu from falling for the secretly sensitive officer. When a powerful official is found dead in a highly suspicious murder, Ming Yu and Wu become involved in the dangerous mystery. Amid the chaos, Wu discovers his reluctant yet fierce attraction to Ming Yu, but the temptation to give in to her could destroy them both. After all, a forbidden affair is bound to have consequences. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on how that description fits the book after you finished it.
Yeah, I think it's pretty accurate. It's pretty solid. I, to be honest, I zoned out a little near the end because I was like, I think I read this description. So I'm sorry. That's not the most detailed
No,
of that.
that's okay.
But yeah, it is definitely like a mystery, and it's, you know, these two people who like have to come together even though they may like otherwise be really opposed.
Yeah, I think it does a good job, like most good romance descriptions, of like sprinkling some interest out but not giving everything away. There's still like lots that you like discover by reading the book. Yeah, I think it's also good that it like says they have a strained history, because if you haven't read the first book, you kind of need that understanding.
Yeah.
I mean, they do like allude to it lots. They talk about the past, and like they do give it away of like what their shared history is. But yeah, I think it also is good that it like does focus on the murder mystery, 'cause that is obviously like one of the major plot points of the book. Like the relationship is obviously important too, but I think the mystery plays a large role in like moving the plot of the book forward.
Yeah, I would really agree with that, and I even though the description discloses it, like it doesn't conceal that. I think I was still a little surprised by just how central the murder mystery was to the plot. Because I think it's one thing to read it in a summary and another to like experience it in the book. And maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, but that is one of the things that I was like initially most, I guess, concerned about when I started reading the book, because I'm so terrible with murder mysteries in romance novels, which is a really difficult thing because so many historicals love a murder mystery.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
But I still think it actually really handled that well.
Yeah, I think it yeah, I wasn't like disappointed, which I was kind of shocked, because usually when I like read, I am a romance person through and through. So like if
Yeah.
you tell me something is romance and the romance is like a secondary plot, I will be mad.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah, like the whole distinction of like fantasy romance and romantic fantasy, I can't even remember what it is now, is like, well, this has just scared me away from everything. But yeah, I found it like it was there was I think there were still parts that kind of dragged for me that like seemed slow. I was like ready for it to like keep moving. But I do think it was interesting. I don't know if you're like this. I assume like when you said you struggle with murder mysteries, this might be part of it, is like it might be like too simple, or it's like you're like, I kind of like get distracted and I'm like, well, I want to know what's going on now. And I just like keep focusing on the murder and I like don't pay attention to the relationship at all, because I'm like, well, you've given all this excitement to me. That's what I want now. I don't care about this relationship anymore. Yeah, but I didn't find that this did this, and it definitely wasn't predictable. Which at least to me
Yeah.
it wasn't, but
Oh yeah, I agree. I didn't predict how the murder mystery was going to be resolved or like some of the twists that came. For me, the thing that I struggle with a murder mystery in a romance novel is that like I want in a romance novel, and this is totally a personal preference, 100% a personal preference. I want the main characters to be on page together, like talking or doing something together at all times. I want them to spend as much time on page together as humanly possible. Like if they were just locked in a room for 350 pages, like that might even be a dream situation for me. And the difficulty is that with a murder mystery, there are a lot of like side quests, right? Like let's go talk to bureaucratic administrator number three. Let's go investigate the henchman. Let's go investigate. You know what I mean? Like some of these like side quests and stuff, I find hard to switch tracks to pay attention to the actual investigation as opposed to like the intimate dynamics, which is what I'm really there for in a romance novel. And like I think the way that this, I similarly sort of struggled with the first third, where I was like, the pacing is a little bit slow. Like, I want it to pick up a little bit faster, but I do ultimately really appreciate the slow burn. But some of the ways that I think this murder mystery was more successful for me were first, like, not being predictable, like you said, but also because I don't know how much of a spoiler this is. We can talk about spoilers, right?
I feel like I should like be upfront about this, and I always forget to say that this is a spoiler podcast. But yeah, no, you can talk about all the spoilers that you want.
Okay, good. Right. So I think part of what I find really compelling about how the murder mystery was incorporated is that Kaifeng actually seriously considers Ming Yu to be a suspect in the murder and takes that really seriously. And so his relationship with her is like built into the nature of the investigation itself in really meaningful ways. And I also think that the mystery itself serves as a proxy for the trust that they're building with each other. Like the investigation and the work that he puts in towards resolving the murder is also it closely parallels the work he's doing to build intimacy with her. And so it serves some sort of like intimate relationship purpose and isn't just like, how do we fill the time before they meet once again? And I think that can sometimes happen with murder mysteries. So I was really grateful for the fact that like it was so deftly incorporated.
Yeah, I completely agree with that point that like that's something I struggle just not even like murder mysteries, just like any side plot that like takes up so much of the time. Because I similarly, when I read a romance novel, I want them to be spending time together. It's the same way that like if I'm reading a romance novel and the characters don't meet until like 15 to 20% into the novel, I'm like, what is this? What is this? This isn't romance. Like you got to meet at the beginning. Come on. But yeah, I appreciate your thought on how like their relationship was built into it because she was considered a suspect. And I think also because like she has this relationship to like all of the people involved, right? Because she knows so many people. And so it's very easy to like intertwine their stories with the murder mystery. And like it all kind of like comes together. Which was, it was very interesting.
I think a lot about that scene where Kaifeng is showing the magistrate the list of potential suspects for the murder, and the list is just like a mile long. Like it's every bodyguard, yes. It's the general's wife, it's Ming Yu, and the magistrate is like, "Am I on this list? Haha!" And then he pauses and like actually looks to make sure he isn't on the list because it's so long. But it was that moment where he's like really making the intentional choice to keep Ming Yu on the list of suspects. It felt like a really thoughtful inclusion given how trusting they were of each other at that point in the relationship.
Yeah, I agree. It was also funny, like, because then the magistrate goes, "Well, who do you actually consider guilty?" And then he's like, "All of them."
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's like very notable for Kifeng's character, is that he is like, yeah, it's so interesting. This is a bit of a sidebar, but when I was like planning these episodes and stuff, in the first episode, which came out, however, 2 weeks ago, I was talking with the guest after about how like I'm done reading like cop romances, like any sort of like romance with like military in it. Just like, I just can't do it anymore. I don't watch those shows anymore. Like it's just slowly become like, it's so, but I'm realizing that like I will make pretty vast exceptions for that for historical romance. And I think it is so notable the difference of reading historical romance that involves like, you know, because like in our, like he's a constable, right? And it's very different, but in our head, like he's still like a quote unquote lawman, right? Like he's there acting on behalf of like the institution of the law, and enacting like punishment based on that. And, but it's so different versus reading like a contemporary novel of like with a police officer, a cop. Are you kidding me? No, like there's no depth, there's no understanding. But I think, and I was recently talking to someone else about this, that like reading historical perspectives of like cops, military, like soldiers, things like that, it offers kind of this exploration of like a different system, a different time, like a different construction of things like justice. Yeah. And like punishment. So I think that was just like something I thought about in this book, because I had just made that comment about like, I'm done reading books about cops. And I was like, Randy, you read historical romance all the time that has like soldiers, yeah, like constables in it. Yeah. And just like really, I don't know, it was a really interesting thing to recognize.
Yeah, I find that so fascinating. And I think it's actually something I'm also sort of grappling with, where like, I find it so distasteful in contemporary romance. Like, I'm just like, I don't find cops attractive. I don't find like military people attractive in contemporary romances. And I also think that like a lot of contemporary romances that present heroes, usually heroes, not to be overly gendered about it, but usually they're heroes who are cops or military professionals. Like, they're just, it's such an uncritical mm-hmm. point of view, right? But in historicals, I think you're more often confronting some of the things that like Kai Feng contends with around like class and being manipulated by larger power structures, and how this was like maybe one of the only pathways forward for him to develop some sort of like financial or other security. How it was like the most tactical use of his skill set. I think you are able to see his relationship with justice as like an extension of his selfhood, and also see like the institution of policing under this state critically. Like, you're able to see how it's not like he had a ton of options available to him, professionally speaking. Like, it's not like he was spoiled for choice as like an underprivileged kid. And so his like presence in that profession feels less like an escapist fantasy as it can sometimes be presented in contemporaries, where it's like, look how hot the police officer uniform is. And I just find like few things more distasteful than that.
Yeah,
I just think it is more complicated. And I also think that like the notion of like crime and punishment, I don't know, I feel like this isn't like a complete thought or a thesis, really. It's just like, it's useful to examine alternate or slightly adjacent points of view on justice through the means of like a historical context.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in this book, so much of it is about bureaucracy. So much of it is about administrative positions, about navigating bureaucracy. And I think that's a really salient part of how state-administered justice operates even now. But you're able to see it really clearly through this like very specific time in Chinese history, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that made any sense, but I think something that I've just been like thinking about a lot.
I mean, I agree with everything you said. Like, it's basically never critical. I can come up with like umpteen examples of how it doesn't critically analyze military. Oftentimes it is really put in a position of like one thing that I reckon with is like, how can you be in the military and leave and still be like, hoorah, like, they destroyed your life, right? Which is like something that I really like can't grasp. And I think military like romance novels have this tendency to really just like idealize that. And even when the hero often comes home with like PTSD, sustained trauma or injuries, and is now disabled, it's not really put in a larger context of like that is because of the military. It's because of like capitalism and like imperialism and like the systems that we have. It's just put on like, oh, this man was injured in the line of duty, he's a hero, and then this woman saves him, or this man saves him. And it really does nothing to break down like the institution, which I just am so bored with, because I'm all about, you know, the institution and like wrecking it.
God, yeah, that is, I mean, it's so true. And I think there's also a lot of like, this person might have worked within a, sometimes if you are getting some sort of confrontation of a system, or like someone who has like a vaguely liberal politic writing about this, you get some like, well, lots and lots of other people are bad, but this one is good. This cop is a good one. This one cares a lot about real justice, even though he might have had a corrupt partner or corrupt whatever, or it's very much like there are good people within a system who like deserve to be championed and celebrated. And I just find that, it's pretty clear ACAB means all,
all cops. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So we have reached our point to take a quick break. So listeners, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more discussion.
Discover Noreen Braun's album, Songs for Trees, dedicated to the forest and the spirits within the trees. As we fight climate change, trees are the lungs of the planet and we need to help them. Her jazz and blues are blended with rock and synthesized pop elements to create a textured and ambient soundtrack to nature. Songs for Trees is a narrative, with each song guiding us through a journey through the forest. A trip, literally and metaphorically, about the interconnectedness of all things. The Vancouver Sun names it one of five albums you need to hear. Find out more at noreenbraun.com.
Over and over again, over and over again. Over and over again.
On January 17th, CITR 101.9 FM presents our annual 24 Hours of Radio Art Programming, featuring innovative approaches to music and sound. It's 24 hours of spoken word, ambient, drone, field recordings, and sound walks, collage, technical support calls, voicemail fails, sound art, and noise. Listen live on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca.
Over and over again. Over and over again. Over and over again.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
Are you tired of Big Brother bookstores trying to sell you some billionaire's favorite book or Heather's top picks? Then you should check out Vancouver Books. Vancouver Books is a new online family-run bookstore. A portion of their profits go to First Nations reconciliation and environmental projects in British Columbia. They provide their customers with the most interesting books in fine arts, signed first editions, First Nations photography, fine ancient books, occult, and so much more. They also provide carbon-free delivery to anywhere in the Vancouver area. So go to www.vancouverbooks.ca to check out Vancouver Books today. That's www.vancouverbooks.ca.
Hello, and welcome back to Dog Ear Radio Book Club. I'm your host, Randy, and I'm joined today by special guest, Sanjana. Thank you so much again for joining me. And we are talking about the book, The Jade Temptress by Jeannie Lin. And we left off before talking about cops and military in romance novels. I think we had some great thoughts. But I did want to kind of move on to like something very directly explored in this book, which is courtesans. Obviously, the Lotus Place is Horn of Courtesans. Ming Yu is the most sought after courtesans. So just as like a content warning to listeners moving forward, we are going to be talking about like sex work and different things relating to that. So just to let you know. So the very first thing that I noticed about this book is this book does not fall into the regular trope of like saviorism, right? Like Ming Yu is not the victim that Kifeng must save from this like villainous person that has taken her and forced her to do all these things. Yeah, and it very much lays more complexity to Mingyu's story, right? She has a lot more agency. She's shown to have her own power. And I think it was really interesting for me to read this because at first I struggled with it because you do find out a lot about her backstory, that a lot of her work as a courtesan started when she was very, very young, when she was a child. And you're really forced to kind of reckon with this image that you create of her, or at least I did, of her being this like strict victim of this forced like forced sex work industry that she is a part of at the Lotus place. And yeah, so I found it really kind of refreshing that it did complicate all of that for me, because I think that there's a fair amount of like stories that we read in like both contemporary and historical that sort of, you know, give you this like flawed and like victim woman character that is then saved by the hero. And this is very much not that. So yeah, I'm really curious of like how you kind of viewed that theme in this book.
Yeah, I was thinking about that like constantly while reading this. I'm sure you were too. Like, it's hard not to want to sit there and try to unpack what the book's sort of statement about sex work is, if at all. And I think the kind of conclusion I came to is that like the author is sort of uninterested in like telling us what to believe about her or her life. And I really appreciated that, actually, because like, yeah, generally speaking, no one but sex workers really should be casting judgment or sort of like offering experienced points of view or whatever on the nobility of their profession or otherwise. And I think it was really kind of cool and refreshing that like, I mean, you took a really sort of mercenary approach to her living. She sort of was like, I'm really, really good at what I do. I'm so good at what I do. I'm an expert. I'm a professional. I'm very capable. I'm teaching other people how to do this. I am the most favored, not just for my beauty, but for like all of these other really complicated political and other skills that she's developed through this. There are moments where she talks about like, yeah, one day I could be serving tea to someone and the next day I could be serving it to his worst enemy. And I need to maintain this like blankness. Like she's not just like an actor or a performer, but she's also a politician. And I think that like, first of all, it's important and necessary to consider the scope of responsibilities that a courtesan or a sex worker or someone in a similar sort of position might be responsible for, right? Like a lot of people sort of see it as like your job is to provide sex, and that certainly is probably the case, but like lots of sex workers talk about what they're doing is also companionship and emotional intimacy and warmth and like confidence boost. I think there's like a kind of richness or texture to her life and the kinds of services that she offers that this book really handles. I also appreciate that there wasn't the like semi-corny scene that I sometimes see in romance where like she asks this like nervous question of like what he thinks about the fact that she's had lots of sexual partners in the past, and he's like, it's not a problem, like I may have had lots of people in the past, but I'm the only one going for it. Like there's none of that. There's no marker of like ownership. There's none of the sort of like typical how many notches on your bedpost conversation. And I also think that it was cool that this book, I don't actually know when this was published. I should probably look that up. I think it's really cool that this book also just talked about it as work, where she was like, yeah, I have experienced some really horrible things. And we are able to sort of bear witness to that through this book. But she also talks about how it has given her financial security and a safe place to be. And there have been like structures and supports in this work that she wouldn't have had on the streets. And I think there's something like necessary about that, about talking about sex work as labor, like real labor that bears consideration. And I think to the sort of point about her starting this work really young, and so much of her sort of core anxieties around agency, autonomy, and ownership, I was sort of compelled by the fact that like yes, those issues and concerns emerge out of the fact that she's done sex work for a really, really, really long time, often under pretty coercive circumstances. And also, like, she's dealing with the patriarchy like lots and lots of women do in general. Mm-hmm. Like, life is easier when you are protected or under the protection of certain men. And
yeah,
the complicated relationship that, like, particularly beautiful young women have with being instrumentalized by the patriarchy is real and not exclusive to sex work, even if it is, in her case, shaped by it.
Yeah.
So I really liked how this book talked about Mingyu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, to answer your question, the book was originally published in 2014. So.
Okay.
Yeah. So that feels like somewhat recent, but not like super recent.
Yeah.
Like 10 years or so.
Me too, at least.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. I feel like in that. Yeah, like, I don't think, I liked how you stated it, that the author isn't telling us what to think. And I think that was, like, what was refreshing about it, because I think that's why my brain had such a hard time wrapping around, like, I had so many notes just, like, as reading this, like, things that I would just, like, think of and say, because it really wasn't trying to, like, guide you down, like, this is bad, this person is bad, this person did a bad thing. Like, it wasn't trying to construct this, like, you know, black or white narrative of good and bad. It was very much like complexity. I think we can still, like, I still very much recognized, like, the villainous nature of, like, the mother of the Lotus Palace. Yeah. I can't remember her name, or if she even had a name. But I think, yeah, so, like, you could still recognize the villainous nature, and, like, same thing with the inspector, his name I'm forgetting, but, like, you could very much still recognize the villainous of this character, but it wasn't that it was, like, it wasn't constructed in this, like, simple, like, Disney sort of way of, like, this is the bad guy, this is the hero destroys the bad guy, and they live happily ever after. Because that's really not real. Like, that doesn't happen. And I think that would have felt so forced in a novel like this, that is, you know, dealing with a lot of these, you know, historical but contemporary issues. And yeah, I found that refreshing as a reader. I still will say that I struggled to, like, in the interactions we had with the young courtesans, you know, like, knowing that they're talking about this character, like, they're talking to this character, and, like, you as the reader know that they're, like, 10, 13 years old. That was definitely something that I think my brain struggled to, like, wrap its head around, and that would just be, I don't know, I think it's something that I would just, like, sit with longer and, like, continue to think about, you know, like, the author creating this, like, broader narrative, right? And choosing to not have all of the courtesans that we interact with as the reader to be, like, quote unquote, of age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's, I think, a really interesting point, especially because Mingyu herself is, like, 28 or 29. She's on the older side. And I think the book itself doesn't necessarily grapple. I mean, it's doing so much other work, so I, like, understand why this maybe wasn't as big in the narrative, but didn't really grapple with what it means to, like, expire in terms of courtesan years, or, like, the sort of fragility of youth and beauty. She's still sort of in her prime, which is interesting given that she's at this point been working for, like, 15 years, and some of the people who she's training, I mean, and they're being groomed to do sex work. Some of the people that she's sort of working with are at the beginning of this very specific journey that has there's, like, a ticking clock. Like, there will be a point at which beauty and novelty fade to the point that, you know, her, like, bodily assets sort of waver. But Yeah, I don't know. I don't really know where I was going with that. I think I just similarly also, but here's the thing. Sorry, this is kind of disjointed. Here's the thing, though. I appreciate that we're kind of, like, confronted with the, like, horrors of this without it being overly explicit and gratuitous. Like, we're sort of passively, as readers of this, horrified. Like, we're aware and horrified by the fact that, like, a child is made to do sex work like this. We're also aware that this is, like, an empirical historical reality for lots and lots and lots of women and girls for generations and generations, not just in China, but everywhere. Mm-hmm. And we're not, like, beat over the head with it, I guess. Yeah. There's just some sort of, like, tacit acknowledgement that, like, this is the way societies have been structured for a really long time all over the world. And, like, we can, like, feel some sense of, like, grief or pain for that without, I don't know, being completely absorbed by that in the narrative. Does that make sense at all? Like,
it does, yeah. And I think kind of building off that, like, other thing I was thinking about is, like, classification of this novel. And we talk a lot about, like, dark romance, and it's typically, like, imagined to be, like, contemporary romances that, like, you know, like, you're dating a mob boss, or, like, you're kidnapped and you fall in love with the person who kidnapped you. Like, it's these very kind of, like, sensationalized, like, romanticizing, or not really romanticizing, I don't want to use that word, but sort of using these, like, very kind of, like, intensely bad behaviors, actors, things like that to, like, you know, create, like, a darker story timeline. And it was something that I was grappling with because we don't really think about it in, like, dark or historical romances. Like, people tend to, like, not really, like, distinguish that label of, like, you know, this is, like, a dark historical romance, or, like, a fluffy historical romance, or things like that. But I do think that this book, because of the themes it's dealing with, and exactly what you were saying, that, like, as the reader, we are confronted with a lot of the harm and atrocities that were taking place, and we know conceptually that this was a real thing. But it's done in a way that it's not, like, it's not meant to be this, like, overt, like, dark narrative to, like, you know, be like, this is all the bad things in the world, and these two people find love and, you know, escape it or whatever. And so I always feel cheesy when I say this, but it made it feel real, right? Like, they're not escaping anything. And they're not, you know, again, it's not the hero destroys the villain. And so, I don't know, I'm just curious of, like, how you would kind of think about, like, you know, that label that we have of, like, dark romance and, like, you know, its role in historical romance and, like, its role specifically for, like, books like this.
That's so interesting. I wouldn't have thought to make or understand this book as a dark romance. I think because of Kai Feng, because he's such, like, a even-keeled, conscientious, rule-abiding individual who is not the villain. I mean, even as he's, you know, a cop, he is not the villain here, compared to, like, literally every other man and most of the women in Ming Yu's life who do seem to, like, possess and own. And I feel like some of the biggest themes in dark romance, I'm not necessarily, like, a fluent dark romance reader. Like, I've definitely read a few, but, like, it's not my genre of choice necessarily. But, like, especially in sort of the mafia or kidnapping or, like, stalker romances and stuff, there's, like, a really heavy theme of ownership and possession, like this desperate desire to, like, have two or more people, whoever, like, whatever the gender makeup is, or, you know, what the partnership structure looks like. In dark romance, I think there's so much around, like, love, ownership, and enmeshment, like this idea that these two people are, like, becoming fully intertwined by force. Like, there's a lot of force involved. And I think dark romance is contemporary's way of, like, leaving an opening to explore, like, the dynamics of non-consent, consensual non-consent or otherwise, and the relationship that has with, like, intimacy and love. Historical, I think the reason why I'm not as prone to associating historicals with dark romance is because, like, historicals already have a complicated relationship with consent structures. The default historical, the most tame historical, has a complicated relationship with consent structures. Like, I think a lot about one of Lisa Kleypas's most famous historicals, one of her most famous books ever. It happened one autumn between Lillian and Marcus. Have you read this book? Sorry if I'm...
I don't think I have. But feel free to talk about it.
Okay. Well, their relationship is like, there's like a little bit of animosity. It's, you know, a typical quick wit. When they like finally consummate their relationship, Lillian is completely smashed. She's so drunk. She's like drunk in the library. He takes her up to his room and they have sex. And this book was published in like the early 2000s. It's not a bodice ripper, though Lisa Kleypas does have like bodice ripper origins. It is by any sort of contemporary definition of a consensual sexual encounter under weird circumstances. Yes, they both ultimately say that they're enthusiastic about the relationship, blah, blah, blah. But like in recent editions of that book, I'm pretty sure the publisher has been taking that scene out. The like scene where she's drunk in the library and they like tumble into bed under coercive circumstances. Like,
yeah,
that scene has been removed because it isn't compatible with like more contemporary ideas of like affirmative consent.
Yeah.
So I think because I'm already predisposed to seeing historical as a genre that like is a little less beholden to consent in the ways that we think of it, the dark label isn't necessarily always useful. Mm-hmm. And I think in this book, at least, because, well, I mean, the sexual encounters between them are consensual.
Yes.
And because Kai Feng is also like not in a position to be able to like own or kidnap or possess Ming Yu, nor does he seem to want to. It kind of, I think, subverts some of our expectations. But yeah, there is the sort of like background horror that just like kind of exists in this book that you can't like walk around.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate your thoughts. And I share a lot of that sentiment. And I think that's why, like, I was thinking about it, because it's been a while since I've read like what I would consider like a bit darker of historical. So like that's not, because a lot of Regency tends to be like very happy, right? Like it's, they tend to have like a lot of friends and like, you know, they have tension and they have these like things that they have to overcome. But at the end of the day, it's like pretty like simple, clear cut that they like come out as like they're winning at the end of it. And so to read a book that kind of subverts some of those expectations just got me thinking about it. But I definitely, we talked about this in my last episode too, with my guest Emily, about how like a lot of historical, it complicates consent. Like consent is just not something you can go into historical romance expecting, having the same expectations as reading like a contemporary romance. You're just not going to get it. Like, and the amount of like scenes that I've read of like, and I think marriage, like consummation is a big part of that, like the ways in which that occurs, you know, like the complexity of that, of like, you know, being like a younger bride married off to this man that you don't really know, and then you're expected to perform this act that you literally know nothing about because no one has ever told you, can lead to like some very frustrating and like complex scenes of intimacy between those characters that I think, yeah, exactly what you said, like it's kind of a part of the genre, and it's I don't know, I think it's a complexity that like can't be forgotten. So I do kind of share that sentiment about this book, and I'm not really sure why I was drawn to that. I had a lot of random thoughts when I was reading this book. I will be very clear, my Kobo notes are just like full of like random things that I was like thinking about, and I was like, I gotta mark this down. And this just like happened to be one of them.
Yeah, and I mean, here's the thing though, like I think that sort of complicated relationship with affirmative enthusiastic consent and historicals is something that can like kind of stress people out or concern them. But I also think that like there's something really brutally honest about it. And it's part of why I'm so drawn to historicals, because like I've always sort of contended that historicals are more honest about the nature of like intimate relations under patriarchy than contemporaries. Yeah. Like they don't pretend at the fact that like men and women are fully equal under a society, and that like sexual dynamics aren't kind of coercive under patriarchy. They just sort of see that more transparently and acknowledge it more transparently through all of these other structures, like the marital contract, or in this book's case, like her purchase as an indentured servant, and what it means to like release her from her bond to the Lotus Palace. And I think that we also have to kind of, I personally want to kind of challenge the idea that like enthusiastic affirmative consent, as we're taught it, is inherently like the way to model like an ethical sexual relationship. I think that like for lots of people, it's an incredibly useful teaching. And like, definitely if you're a first year in college and like need a lesson on how to be good to other people, then like maybe this is a good starting point. But I also think that like, I just think that consent is more complicated. I think there are lots and lots of reasons why the sort of contractual, enthusiastic, affirmative yes is the beginning of something and not the end of what constitutes good sexual relations. And like, I just think that historicals are sometimes a lot more honest about what that actually constitutes.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. And I think that's a perfect way to end off this episode because we have reached the end of our time. I knew it would be easy. I knew it would be easy with a book like this and a guest like you. So thank you so much for coming on my show. Before we finish up, do you just want to tell the listeners where they can find more of you?
Sure. You can find me on TikTok or Instagram or Twitter/X, whatever you're calling it, at Baskinsons, BASKINSUNS. I also have a Substack called Scratch Paper. Or you can email me, baskinsons@gmail.com. I don't know why you would need to email me, but you can, and I will hopefully respond to you. But yeah, Instagram and TikTok is probably best.
Okay, amazing. Yes, definitely go give her a follow on TikTok. That's how I found out. And your latest is on Monster Romance, which is so interesting. I love it so much. So thank you so much to the listeners for listening. We will be back in another couple of weeks. So make sure you tune in for that episode and have a great rest of your night.